WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you. Right now, whenever that happens to be. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth, and the powerful effect your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. A happy belated July 4th to all of our listeners. In addition to the festivities and fireworks that took place across the country, something else was happening that was much more significant and impactful. That is, the enormous heat wave that we saw all over the United States and in Europe. On July 4th, it was 102 degrees in Washington, D.C., and France saw temperatures as high as 111 degrees. What was stunning about this heat wave was that it not only broke records, but it did so by margins far above previous all-time highs. And Western Europe's June heat wave was the most severe ever. Over this past week alone, extreme climate-driven heat claimed the lives of at least 40 Americans. And 22 of those deaths happened right here in New Jersey. People found in cars, on the street, in homes without air conditioning. And if you think that's an isolated incident, look across the Atlantic. Europe just experienced, as I had mentioned, the most extreme heat wave in its recorded history, with preliminary data showing a staggering loss of over 20,000 lives in a single week. More than 20,000 people. That isn't just summer weather. That is a systemic failure. The data is screaming at us, but our collective survival mechanism has broken down so badly that we treat 20,000 deaths like a footnote below some objectively meaningless political headlines. Dr. Frederick Otto is a leading climate scientist at Imperial College London and co-founder of World Weather Attribution. Regarding recent heat fatalities, she explicitly stated, quote, "Scientists like me are beginning to sound like a broken record, reacting year after year to heat extremes that climb ever higher. Yes, this is climate change. Yes, it's us. Yes, we have solutions. No, we're not implementing them fast enough." End quote. Now, if you think that this heat was an anomaly, the experts disagree. Scientists who have spent their lives studying climate trends say that the recent record-shattering heat waves over the 4th of July weekend in the U.S. and the devastating heat waves in Europe would be, quote, "virtually impossible," end quote, without human-caused climate change. Climate models show that while the weather patterns that cause a heat wave, such as a high-pressure heat dome trapping hot air, are natural, the background climate has been so heavily warmed by fossil fuel emissions that the same weather pattern now produces vastly more dangerous, record-breaking temperatures. And it's not just the temperature numbers on the screen. It's how the heat is behaving and how we're feeling it. Because a warmer atmosphere holds more moisture. Recent heat waves are bringing with them unprecedented humidity levels. Meteorologists note that this combination is pushing human coping mechanisms to the literal limit because the air is too muggy for sweat to evaporate effectively and cool the body. And that's one reason why more and more areas of our planet are becoming too hot for humans and other animals to live. There's something else that climate scientists talk about, called the multiplier effect. And that was exactly the case here, as climate change didn't just cause the heat wave. It significantly increased the odds of this kind of heat event. Climate scientists use a scale called the Climate Shift Index. For the recent extreme heat bands across the major parts of the US and Europe, the index reached its highest possible level, which is level number 5. This means human-caused climate change made this extreme heat at least 5 times more likely to occur. Consider this. 2023, 24, and 25 are now officially verified as the 3 hottest years in recorded history. With global surface temperatures averaging a staggering 1.44 degrees Celsius, or 2.6 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. To better understand how fast this acceleration is happening, look at the historical data. The World Meteorological Organization just confirms that the past 11 years have been the 11 warmest years ever recorded in human history. In fact, if you look at the top 25 hottest years on record, 24 of them have occurred right here in the 21st century. This isn't a slow, natural cycle of heating that you may have heard it was. It's a compressed, massive spike occurring entirely on our watch. This, and more, has prompted the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres to issue stark warnings that unchecked climate change is making the planet uninhabitable. Addressing the climate change, he noted, quote, "Several parts of our planet will be uninhabitable, and for many, this is a death sentence," end quote. Warning that current trajectories could drive parts of the globe to a point of irreversible climate chaos. The Secretary General's warnings highlight several immediate threats. The first is rising temperatures. Guterres cautions that humanity's continued addiction to fossil fuels is driving the world toward a catastrophic 2.8 degrees Celsius of global warming by the end of the century, pushing life beyond crucial tipping points. Second is extreme weather. Failure to take urgent action is rapidly intensifying heat waves, droughts, flooding, and wildfires, leading to widespread loss of farming land and fresh water sources. The third threat is rising sea levels. For low-lying countries and coastal areas, rising sea levels pose an existential threat that threatens to submerge cities and force mass displacement. On that note, it's worth mentioning that ocean temperatures just reached a new high for early summer. Also, on another rather chilling note related to the current sea level rise event, there is a loss of Antarctic sea ice. In the past month, if you've been keeping track, part of the Thwaites Glacier, otherwise known as the Doomsday Glacier, is about to break away from Antarctica. It could be any day now, according to experts. This has substantial implications for sea level rise, as Thwaites's eastern ice shelf has been acting as a buttress that has prevented the loss of large portions of Antarctic ice capable of raising sea levels by feet, not inches. This, however, I'm happy to say, is a long-term outcome that won't be happening in this century. But the loss of the eastern ice shelf will be making this happen considerably faster. All that I've mentioned so far is just a small snippet of the global situation we're facing, and it explains some of the climate change impacts that so many of us were experiencing, knowingly and unknowingly, during last week's deadly heat wave. Now, climate change is a global phenomenon, but it's certainly being felt locally beyond the extreme heat we just talked about. Most New Yorkers don't know that climate change is also driving significant increases in sea level rise, chronic tidal flooding, and extreme rainfall across New York City and Long Island. And that the impacts of these changes are not future projections. They're actively reshaping local infrastructure and threatening low-lying communities. Today, just this week, torrential downpours prompted Nassau and Suffolk counties to declare a state of emergency due to flash flooding, showing just how rapidly the region's coastal and drainage systems can become overwhelmed. Now, if I were to ask those of you listening to this show, how much do you think sea level on the south shore of Long Island has risen in the past century due to rising global temperatures? What would you say? Take a guess in your own mind. How much has sea level risen on the south shore of Long Island in the past century? The answer is that sea level on the south shore has risen by approximately 12 to 15 inches in the past century, which is significantly faster than the global average rate of sea level rise. Local tide gauge data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shows that water levels are currently rising at an accelerating rate of nearly 1 inch every 7 to 8 years. And when I say accelerating, I mean that the pace of sea level rise is speeding up year after year. And if you think 100 years is a long time, you're thinking in human terms. Geologically, 100 years is not even the blink of an eye. And with all that said, just think about what we chose to focus on over the 4th of July weekend. Political rallies, partisan bickering, the debacle of the reflecting pool, and on the positive side, some great gatherings and holiday travel. But all the while, with all this small-minded discussion going on about irrelevant and unimportant things, a quiet catastrophe was happening right outside our windows. And this catastrophe is not something we didn't see coming. To show you how long this wealth of scientific information that predicted what we're living through today has been available to our policymakers, I want to take you back in a time machine more than 40 years. The startling clip I'm going to play you right now would make perfect sense if it was recorded last week. But it was not. This clip is from 1985, and it's of Dr. Carl Sagan, who sat before Congress and mapped out exactly where we stand today. He was not a religious prophet. He didn't have a magical power or a look into the future with a crystal ball. He was simply a scientist who knew how to read and communicate the science that was clear as day, even 40 years ago. Listen in with that in mind. Dr. Carl Sagan, 1985.
Our next witness is Dr. Carl Sagan of Cornell University, a man who needs no introduction. He comes to us today from the Center for Radiophysics and Space Sciences. We welcome you, and we're very pleased that you would take the time out of your schedule to come to a place like Washington, where everything seems to be living in today and not in tomorrow, to share with us your particular view of how our past and our present may well affect our future. Carl, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Senator Durenberger, Senator Gore, Senator Burdick. I'm glad to be here. As I understand my function, it is to give some sense of what the greenhouse effect is, to try to say something about greenhouse effect on other planets, to again underscore that this is a real phenomenon, and then perhaps I can take the liberty to say a few remarks about what to do about it. The power of human beings to affect and control and change the environment is growing as our technology grows. And at present time, we clearly have reached the stage where we are capable, both intentionally and inadvertently, to make significant changes in the global climate and in the global ecosystem. And we've probably been doing, on a smaller scale, things like that for a very long period of time. For example, slash and burn agriculture, which has been with us for tens of thousands of years probably, changes the climate to some extent by changing the albedo, the reflectivity of the Earth. That massive changes have occurred is clear from the historical record. For example, Egypt was once the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. It may be the same role as the American Midwest plays, today. That is certainly no longer the case. It's not a greenhouse effect issue. It may be an overgrazing issue, but is an example of how humans are perfectly capable of making these unexpected and inadvertent changes. Because the effects occupy more than a human generation, there is a tendency to say that they are not our problem. Of course, then they are nobody's problem. Not on my tour of duty, not on my term of office. It's something for the next century. Let the next century worry about it. But the problem is that there are effects, and the greenhouse effect is one of them, which have long-time constants. If you don't worry about it now, it's too late later on. And so in this issue, as in so many other issues, we are passing on extremely grave problems for our children when the time to solve the problems, if they can be solved at all, is now. If you ask what determines the Earth's climate, clearly the main thing that determines it is sunlight. Sunlight is what heats the Earth. Not all the light that arrives at the Earth from the sun goes to heating the Earth. Some of it is reflected back. It's just the part that is absorbed. And what happens is there's a certain rate at which sunlight is absorbed by the Earth's surface, and there's a certain rate at which the Earth's surface radiates to space. What comes from the sun is in the ordinary visible part of the spectrum that our eyes are sensitive to. What the Earth radiates into space is in the infrared part of the spectrum, longer waves than red, that our eyes are not sensitive to, but it's as legitimate a form of light as the kind that we're used to. Now, if you calculate what the temperature of the Earth ought to be from how much sunlight is being absorbed, equaling how much infrared radiation would be radiated to space, you find that the Earth's temperature, by this simple calculation, is too low. It's about 30 centigrade degrees too low. And why is it too low? It's too low because something was left out of the calculation. What was left out of the calculation? The greenhouse effect. The air between us is transparent, except in Los Angeles and places of that sort, in the ordinary visible part of the spectrum. We can see each other. But if our eyes were sensitive at, say, 15 microns in the infrared, we could not see each other. The air would be black between us, and that's because, in this case, carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is very strongly absorbing at 15 microns and other wavelengths in the infrared. Likewise, there are parts of the infrared spectrum where water vapor absorbs, where we could not see each other if we were only as far apart as we are in this room. If you add these infrared absorbing gases to a planetary, to a planet, then what happens is the sunlight comes in as before, but when the surface tries to radiate to space in the infrared, it is blocked, it is impeded by the absorbing gases. And so the surface temperature has to rise so that there is an equilibrium between what comes in and what goes out. So this is the greenhouse effect. It is a misnomer for more reasons than one. It's a misnomer in particular because that's not how the florist greenhouse works, but that's a very minor point. There are other gases which absorb in the infrared, many of which have been mentioned already, nitrous oxide, methane, the halocarbons, and these are products partly of agriculture, as fertilizers, refrigeration, aerosol spray cans, and so on, all products of our technology. We don't generate much water into the atmosphere, but we certainly do generate a great deal of carbon dioxide through the burning of wood and fossil fuels, an apparently benign activity. Who could object to humans burning oil and coal, gas, and wood? I'd like to stress that the greenhouse effect makes life on Earth possible. If there were not a greenhouse effect, the temperature would, as I say, be 30 centigrade degrees or so colder, and that's well below the freezing point of water everywhere on the planet. The oceans would be solid after a while. A little greenhouse effect is a good thing. But there is a delicate balance of these invisible gases, and too much or too little greenhouse effect can mean too high or too low a temperature. And here we are, pouring enormous quantities of CO2 and these other gases into the atmosphere every year with hardly any concern about its long-term and global consequences. Now, certainly not all aspects of how increased CO2 and other gases into the atmosphere affect the climate are known. There are still many uncertainties, although the overall picture is, I think, quite clear and quite widely understood and accepted. But there are questions about aerosols, about clouds. You heat up the Earth. How much increase or decrease in cloudiness is there? How does that change the albedo or reflectivity of the Earth? There's questions about the ocean and its response time to an increase in CO2. There are feedback effects. Therefore, it is certainly worthwhile to spend some additional money on further research on the subject. Another point is that the significant temperature changes on the Earth between ice ages and out of ice ages, glacial and interglacial time periods, seems to be connected with quite small changes in the amount of sunlight that reaches the Earth due to changes in the Earth's orbital properties, and that is a suggestion that the Earth's climate system may be very delicately dependent on the sorts of factors that we're talking about here, and that's why it makes sense to study past climatic change on the Earth as an attempt to obtain some calibration. Another source of calibration is the other planets. Every planet with an atmosphere has some degree of a greenhouse effect. The most spectacular case by far is the greenhouse effect of Venus. It's the nearest planet. It's a planet about the same mass, radius, density as the Earth, but it is spectacularly different in several respects, one of which is that the surface temperature is about 470 degrees centigrade, 900 Fahrenheit, and that enormous temperature is not due to its being closer to the sun, because Venus is surrounded with bright clouds, and in fact, because it reflects so much light back to space, if that's all that was happening, it would be cooler, not warmer, than the Earth. The reason for this absurdly high temperature on the surface of Venus, which is well understood. I mean, Soviet spacecraft have landed on Venus and, in effect, stuck out a thermometer. There's no doubt that the surface temperature is very high, and later U.S. spacecraft have as well. The reason is a massive greenhouse effect in which carbon dioxide plays the major role. Now, the amount of CO2 in the Venus atmosphere is much larger than here. The atmosphere is almost entirely carbon dioxide, and there's 90 times more of it there than here. But it is an indication of what can happen in an extreme case. You look at Mars or Jupiter or Titan, the big moon of Saturn, and you have additional examples of greenhouse effects. Different gases, different amounts of sunlight reaching the surface, different planetary albedos and cloudiness. And in all those cases, there is also a greenhouse effect. In addition, it has been possible to calculate those greenhouse effects fairly accurately, so that the kind of theoretical armamentarium which is used to calculate the greenhouse effect changes on the Earth, is also used for other planets and therefore can be calibrated to some extent against those other planets. If we keep coming out with the right answer in all those different cases, then probably we understand fairly well how greenhouse effects work. It would, however, be worthwhile, in along the lines that Senator Gore was talking about, to have an increased program through NASA to understand the greenhouse effects on other planets. This might be a very practical application of planetary exploration. As you've heard, the best estimates, they certainly have some uncertainty attached to them, are that at the present rate of burning of fossil fuels, the present rate of increase of minor infrared absorbing gases in the Earth's atmosphere, that there will be a several centigrade degree temperature increase on the Earth, global average, by the middle to the end of the next century, and that has a variety of consequences, including redistribution of local climates and through the melting of glaciers, an increase in global sea level. There is concern on a somewhat longer time scale about the collapse of the West Antarctic ice sheet and a general rise of many, many meters in sea level. So we have a kind of handwriting on the wall. Certainly there's more research to be done, but as I say, there is a consensus. What can be done about it? The idea that we should immediately stop burning fossil fuel has such severe economic consequences that no one, of course, will take it seriously. But there are many other things that can be done. One has to do with subsidies for fossil fuels. More efficient use could be encouraged by fewer government subsidies. Secondly, there are alternative energy sources, some of which are useful, at least locally. Solar power is certainly one that might be of more general use. Safe fission power plants, which are in principle possible. And then on a longer time scale, the prospect of fusion power. Fission and fusion power plants, in principle, vent no infrared active gases, and therefore, whatever other problems they may provide, they do not provide a greenhouse problem. I'd like to close by just saying a few words on the kind of perspective that this problem, as related problems, pose to us. Here is a problem which transcends our particular generation. It is an intergenerational problem. If we don't do the right thing now, there are very serious problems that our children and grandchildren will have to face. It is also a global problem. It is no good if just one or two major industrial nations take major steps to prevent a major increase still further in CO2 and other greenhouse gases, because other nations may, through their industrial development, cause the problem by themselves. And not to say that this is inevitable, but just to give an example. The largest coal reserves on the planet are the United States, Soviet Union, and China. China is undergoing a very major industrial development. And the burning of coal is certainly something that must be very attractive for the Chinese looking into the future. I would say that there is no way to solve this problem, even if the United States and the Soviet Union were to come to a perfectly good accord on this issue, without involving China and many other nations that will be developing rapidly in the time period we're talking about. So here is a sense in which the nations to deal with this problem have to make a change from their traditional concern about themselves and not about the planet and the species. A change from the traditional short-term objectives to longer-term objectives. And we have to bear in mind that in problems like this, the initial stages of global temperature increase, one region of the planet might benefit while another region of the planet suffers. And there has to be a kind of trading off of benefits and suffering. And that requires a degree of international amity which certainly doesn't exist today. I think that what is essential for this problem is a global consciousness, a view that transcends our exclusive identifications with the generational and political groupings into which by accident we have been born. The solution to these problems requires a perspective that embraces the planet and the future, because we are all in this greenhouse together. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Once again, that was Dr. Carl Sagan testifying before Congress in 1985. He was a legendary astrophysicist, best-selling author, and master science communicator who spends his life making the universe and our responsibility to protect our own planet understandable to millions. Keep in mind that because this happened in 1985, he was speaking about solar power that was in a very early stage of development compared to where it is today. Back in the 1980s, my father had solar hot water on his house, and he had a geothermal heat pump. But that was quite unusual for the time. Consider this. Between 1985 and today, the cost of solar equipment has gone down by 97%. Dr. Sagan was still listing solar power as a solution back then. On the other hand, the price of nuclear power, even adjusting for inflation, the real capital cost to build new nuclear power has roughly tripled or quadrupled since 1985. So any solutions that they would have considered back then are very, very different today. So there's no question that if Dr. Sagan were talking about solutions in the modern world, he would be talking about how the clear, easy, technologically available, and cost-effective way to address this challenge is by putting our resources and our support behind clean energy technologies that are available today. We were given warning. We had the time. We had the technology. So what happens to the political will to stop us from taking on this challenge over the past four decades? This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're taking a post 4th of July weekend's look back at what was the really big story that very few were talking about. That is the current deadly impact of climate change in our world, not at some future point in time, but now, today, and tomorrow. I asked the question, what happens to our political will to stop something that we knew was happening, we knew it was coming, we knew that it was getting worse, and we knew that we had to take immediate action on 40 years ago and more? Well, those who have heard me speak over the last couple of decades know that I consider climate change to be a threat to the stability of our society. No question about it. There are not many more urgent and potentially dangerous issues facing our world today. And yet, I'm seeing that there is one issue that I hadn't really considered until the last few years that rivals climate change and its potential to tear apart society and lead to a devastating future. And that is the rise of global misinformation and disinformation. It has the power to pit neighbor against neighbor, family against family. And that's because mis and disinformation create a situation where there can be two people who passionately believe that they are fighting for the truth. But since they believe in different truths, their passion can pit them against each other. This crisis of truth threatens us not only in regard to science and climate change, but on almost every other issue that we can all get passionate about. It erodes the fabric of a unified society. Many of you who are listening to this show can likely relate to the effect this crisis is having on your relationships with some family and some friends. The World Economic Forum is an international organization for public-private cooperation based in Geneva, Switzerland. It engages political, business, and cultural leaders to shape global, regional, and industry agendas. The World Economic Forum puts out an annual Global Risks Report. Its purpose is to analyze and track the most severe emerging threats over the immediate, short, and long term. That report is grounded in the Global Risks Perception Survey that draws on insights from over 1,300 global experts. It underscores how geopolitical, societal, environmental, and technological disruptions are converging. The majority of the over 1,300 respondents to that survey signal a negative global outlook for both the short and long term. 50% characterize the short-term outlook as turbulent or stormy. 57% characterize the long-term outlook at similar levels. This survey ranked geoeconomic confrontation as the top risk for both 2026 and 2028, reflecting a rise in nationalism, weakening alliances, and escalating state-based conflicts. Just think about how our relationship with our friends in Europe has changed over the last 2 years. Alliances that were forged more than 75 years ago are now being held together by a thread. The survey explicitly ranked the number two greatest threat to short-term stability in the entire world. And that number two threat is none other than misinformation and disinformation. And I'll also mention that the survey found that by 2036, environmental risks overwhelmingly dominate the top of the list, led by extreme weather events, biodiversity loss, and irreversible changes to Earth systems. And that brings me to the next clip I'm going to be playing. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She's going to be speaking in this clip on misinformation and distrust in science. She'll talk about why bad actors create mistrust in science in the first place, how they do it, how the fossil fuel industry creates distrust, and more. Again, this is Harvard's Naomi Oreskes.
Hi, I'm Naomi Oreskes. I'm the Henry Charles Lee Professor of the History of Science at Harvard University and Affiliated Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences.
Why do bad actors act to create mistrust in science?
One of the sad things about the period we live in now is that there are people in the world who are deliberately trying to foment distrust in science. And they do this primarily by raising doubt. My most well-known book is called Merchants of Doubt. They sell doubt about science in order to undermine public trust in science. So why did they do that? Well, usually for one of two reasons. They either have an economic interest, so scientists maybe have demonstrated the harms of a commercial product, like tobacco or fossil fuels, or they have a political or ideological interest. They believe in free market economics, and they worry that if climate change is real, we're going to have to regulate the marketplace for fossil fuels. And so in our work, we've looked at both, and we've studied how organizations ranging from the tobacco industry, the fossil fuel industry, but also right-wing libertarian think tanks like the Cato Institute in the United States, how they deliberately foment distrust in science. And one of the really sad things about the present period is that they've succeeded. So there are plenty of good reasons why we might be skeptical of any particular scientific claim. People should have a certain degree of healthy skepticism about particular scientific claims. So there's nothing wrong with asking the question, well, how do you know that? What is the evidence? What is the basis for that? But what groups like the tobacco and the fossil fuel industry have done is to generate a corrosive skepticism, a skepticism that makes people not just ask reasonable questions, but just reject science categorically. And that puts public health, public safety, and the environment at serious risk.
How do bad actors create mistrust in science?
The most well-studied example of doubt-mongering comes from the tobacco industry. We now have many years of research on this. There have been many lawsuits through which documents have become available that really prove what the tobacco industry did and why they did it, so we don't have to speculate. And so one of the key strategies they use is to challenge the causal relations. So for example, it's very, very, very well established now, and virtually all people know it, that smoking causes cancer. It also causes about 100 other different horrible diseases. But for the longest time, the tobacco industry would challenge that by saying, well, we don't really know for sure because, you know, there are other things that cause cancer too. For example, asbestos causes cancer. Radon exposure causes cancer. And so you see how tricky this is because it's not a lie. They don't have to lie in order to confuse us. So it's not really based on lying, it's based on confusion.
How does the fossil fuel industry create distrust?
The fossil fuel industry is still current, and it's a really important example because climate change is one of the most serious threats we face in the world today. We know the scientific evidence is overwhelming, and scientists predicted this, that The carbon dioxide in our atmosphere has increased dramatically, about 40% since the Industrial Revolution, and we know that's changed the climate system in ways that are damaging people around the globe, making heat waves worse, making flood events worse, intensifying hurricanes and cyclones and other tropical storms, and people are being hurt, properties are being damaged, people are being killed. So this is an extremely serious problem that we all need to face together, but the fossil fuel industry continues to say, well, we don't really know, it might be natural variability. So it's exactly the same strategy as the tobacco industry used. How do we know it's fossil fuels? How do we know it's carbon dioxide? Now, of course, the answer is we know because we've built models that test what the world looks like with and without the burning of fossil fuels. We can show that many of the heat waves that are happening now could not have happened had the amount of energy in the system not been increased by fossil fuels. We know it's not natural variability of the sun because we have direct measurements of solar radiation. So we actually have many good lines of evidence that tell us, yes, this is burning fossil fuels, but the industry continues to cast doubt on that. And they also they cast doubt on the alternatives. They say, oh, renewable energy, it's too expensive, it's not reliable enough, it's too intermittent. But of course, it could be reliable enough if we had enough of it.
How does the fossil fuel industry create distrust?
The distrust in science is quite closely linked to distrust in government, and that's one of the reasons this is such a difficult issue, because of course, sometimes we're right to distrust our government. And a lot of science in the modern world is tied to government. In the United States, the United Kingdom, in many parts of Europe and in China, the vast majority of science is funded through the public purse, through government. So people are right to ask questions. It's never wrong to ask a question, but it is wrong to refuse to accept the answer. And the scientific community has done so much work to demonstrate the reality of climate change, the efficacy of masks, the safety of most vaccines, not all, but most. So why do we still have this gap? And one of the reasons we have the gap is because scientists have not done enough to talk to people, to get out of their laboratories, to get out of their ivory towers, and to be there with people to talk about our work and to answer people's questions. I wrote a book called Why Trust Science? And part of the reason I wrote that book was because I was giving a public talk in the United States, in the heartland, and I was doing a lot of work explaining climate science and all the hard work that scientists had done to bring us to this moment where we really do understand what's happening in the climate system in a pretty robust way. And a man stood up and he said, well, that's all very well and good, but why should we trust the science? And I thought, oh, that's a good question, right? So I think that a lot of scientists have taken it for granted that people know why they should trust science. I think a lot of scientists have taken it for granted that science is a public good, and that people know that, and therefore it should be obvious. But I think one of the things we've learned in recent decades is that it's not obvious. We have to explain it. We have to do more work to explain to people not just what we know, but how we know it. Now, the other part of it, though, that is very hard is it's not a level playing field. The amount of money that goes into disinformation is massively greater than the amount of money that goes into explaining information. So I do think that scientific institutions have to recognize that you have to put some money into this. I've worked in many institutions in my life that are great institutions that produce great knowledge, but if you ask them to spend money on communication, then they say, oh, that's not our job, that's someone else's job, except it isn't actually anyone else's job. You look around, you think, okay, well, who else is doing this? And then you realize, first of all, no one else is doing it, and no one else really can, because scientists have to explain science because we're the ones who understand it.
This is Bob DiBenedetto with The Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. We're taking a look at climate change and how it's fueled by mis and disinformation. And we're listening to a piece on that very topic by Harvard's Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science. Does it matter who funds science?
Well, there isn't necessarily a key difference. It really depends on the situation. So we certainly have many times in the past where private organizations have funded science very effectively. In the early 20th century in the United States, most science was not funded by the US federal government. It was funded either by the states, by private philanthropists, groups like the Rockefeller Foundation, or private sector. So in the early 20th century, a tremendous amount of important scientific work was done in industrial research labs at big companies like Westinghouse or General Electric in the United States, or some of the big chemical companies in Germany. But the problem with relying on the private sector is that there are many things that the private sector either can't or won't do. And particularly in the modern world, where there's a lot of pressure on corporations to report quarterly profits, science typically is a long-term investment. It can take a long time, a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, to sort out big scientific questions. And so most private sector actors, they just won't do that because there's no short-term profit in it. And that's where the public sector comes in. The public sector is able to make the long-term commitment to scientific research, to build and sustain scientific capacity so that we have it when we need it. And we really saw that during COVID because both here in the United Kingdom, in Europe, and in the United States, vaccines were developed quite rapidly. And a lot of that work was done in the private sector, companies like Pfizer and Moderna. But they were able to do it because they were building on decades of publicly funded basic science. And if we hadn't had that foundation of basic science funded by the public purse, the private sector actors would not have been able to achieve what they did. There's also an awful lot of science that makes the world a better place, helps us understand our place in the universe, but doesn't necessarily yield a product that you can sell at a profit, at least not in the next few weeks or months or years. So that's where the public funding is so important, that it's complementary to the private sector. This isn't an argument against the private sector. It's an argument for the fact that there are just many things that the private sector doesn't provide adequately. I mean, my most recent book, The Big Myth, is all about this, that the private sector is very effective at doing certain kinds of things, but completely ineffective at doing other kinds of things. And so that's why you need to have both. And the other thing that's really important about the public sector is the way it's able to build capacity. So when we invest in science education, when we invest in universities, when we pay for postgraduate students and postdocs and assistant professors, when we pay their salaries, we're building scientific capacity and scientific infrastructure. You know, if you think about the COVID pandemic, if we didn't have the whole infrastructure of science and decided, oh, we have to only now train microbiologists and train virologists and train immunologists, that would have been a completely hopeless project. And the analogy I like to think to use is to compare it to the military. I mean, we could argue about how much military preparedness we need and how many aircraft carriers and how many bombers and things like that. But, you know, the vast majority of people would acknowledge that in the reality of the world as it is, countries need to have military defenses. No one would say, oh, don't build an aircraft carrier because we'll just build it when we need it. Because we would know that if we were invaded, you can't just build an aircraft carrier overnight. We would know that you can't just train troops overnight. And we have the experience of history that proves to us why, when it comes to the military, we have to be prepared. But it's the same with science. When things happen, like a pandemic, you need to have that capacity in place. You can't just suddenly say, oh, now that we need it, we'll do it. It doesn't work that way.
What role does government regulation play in science?
So regulation isn't really a question about science, it's really a question about markets. So one of the things we know in the modern world is that markets fail, and when they fail, you need some kind of intervention from outside the marketplace. And that could be a consumer intervention, but in most cases, it's a government intervention. So climate change is the obvious case in point. We buy fossil fuels, we put petrol in our cars, but we don't really pay the true cost of those products because those products are causing huge amounts of damage, trillions of dollars in damage. That's what economists will say externalized. So they, you know, that damage doesn't show up in the price we pay. Governments have to step in order to remedy the market failure and protect consumers, workers, the natural environment, biodiversity, whatever it is. The way that science gets involved in this conversation is that it's science that's proving the external costs. And this is something that I think a lot of people miss. You know, when you think about climate change as an external cost, it wasn't economists who said, oh, we have a problem here. It was scientists. So it's scientists, natural scientists, who figured that out. And so scientists became the target of attack by people who opposed regulating fossil fuels. And some of those people opposed it out of pure greed, but others oppose it out of some idea that government regulation in the marketplace isn't a good idea. And I understand that argument, and clearly, to the extent that it works to let the private sector function without a lot of government bureaucracy, then of course, I think almost everybody would say, sure, we would like that as much as possible. But when we know that private sector activities, commercial activity is doing damage, then this is a real problem. And so science comes in as a kind of reality check, a kind of ground truth that yes, this damage is real and we know what's causing it. And so we have to address that cause. And in many cases, that does mean the government has to become involved in the marketplace to do something to remedy the market failure.
How does the concept of freedom affect the climate debate?
So one of the arguments that people sometimes make, people who are leery of government regulation, is that they say it's a denial of freedom. And in our work, we've shown how this argument has been weaponized against science to say, oh no, if you regulate the marketplace, if you regulate fossil fuels, if you regulate tobacco, if you put a price on carbon, you're taking away my freedom. And this has been used to frighten people, to make people afraid of something like a carbon tax or an emissions trading system. And this is really pernicious. And it's pernicious for two reasons. First of all, if we don't fix these problems, we will lose our freedom in many other ways. So imagine your house burning down and everything you owned being destroyed, which is what happened to people in California this past year. I mean, that's a very weird kind of conception of freedom, to think that you're now, it's okay because I'm free. No, it's not okay. You've been incredibly badly hurt. And also, it's a really mistaken conception of freedom, because of course, my freedom to live the life I want runs up against the limits of libertarianism when my freedom hurts someone else. So we would never say that you have a freedom to kill someone, right? Murder is illegal. We don't say you have the freedom to steal someone else's property. You say, no, that's their property. And yet somehow people are trying to say we have the freedom to burn fossil fuels, dump carbon pollution in the atmosphere, even though in the end it is stealing from other people who are now losing their property. And it could, in some cases, even be murder when those people's, you know, if those people are killed in a flood or a wildfire. So society, civil society, has always understood the notion of competing freedoms. There's a famous line that we sometimes use in America, my freedom to throw a punch ends just before your nose, right? I mean, I don't have the freedom to just do anything I want. What I want to do has to be balanced against the common good and the general welfare. And every government in the world has always recognize that, you know, the preamble to the U.S. Constitution says in order to provide for the general welfare. But I feel like we've somehow lost this notion of the general welfare, and we've lost it in part because industries like the fossil fuel industry, like the tobacco industry and their allies have tried to make us think that we shouldn't care about the general welfare, we should just care about our own personal interests. And that's hugely damaging. It flies in the face of the entire history of democratic society. And it's not even what Adam Smith said, and that might be my next book.
That was again Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Now, she mentions Adam Smith, and it's worth saying just a little bit about him. First, Adam Smith, for those of you who don't know, is widely labeled as the father of modern economics, with his creation of his classical free market economic theory. He lived in the 1700s. But those who see him as the originator or hero of free market capitalism often miss the point and mischaracterize his perspective on topics such as the one we're talking about today, climate change and pollution. Many of you probably haven't heard this before, but self-identified believers in free markets will often object to any limitations upon markets. So they would say that fossil fuels should be allowed to thrive and that the market should determine what energy we use and how we use it. And yet, their hero, Adam Smith, would likely not agree. Adam Smith argued that when producers pursue profit, they sometimes pass on hidden costs to society, such as the public health risks of burning fossil fuels. Those hidden costs are the ones that Naomi Oreskes referred to as externalities. And again, those external costs are not covered in the price that we pay for gasoline or coal or energy that comes from fossil fuel burning. So again, Adam Smith's logic suggests taxing or regulating fossil fuels to reflect the true societal cost of carbon pollution that's destabilizing our atmosphere and literally killing us. So anyone who tells you that the free market says that we shouldn't interfere and purports to believe in Adam Smith is not taking into account the fact that he did understand that the free market does not regulate everything fairly. And therefore, there is a role for government to play in making sure that the public is not paying for the sins of producers, and that the producers are not profiting unduly by destroying the resources owned by the public. That's right, that's us. In this case, fresh air, clean water, a stable climate, and more. To bring it home, I'll mention one of those external costs that you're likely already paying if you live on Long Island. That is the climate change-triggered insurance crisis on Long Island, characterized by spiking premiums, stricter coverage limits, and a noticeable retreat by national insurers. Have you looked at your insurance bill over the last couple of years? Moody's Investors Services has flagged Long Island as one of the most climate-vulnerable coastal regions in the United States, prompting underwriters to aggressively adjust how they price and issue policies in Nassau and Suffolk counties. Standard homeowners insurance premiums on Long Island have climbed anywhere from 12 to 30% in recent renewal cycles. For homeowners, I don't have to tell you this, you already know it. And for properties directly along the South Shore, North Shore, and East End Bays, some homeowners have seen their renewal premiums double. Yes, each increased insurance bill you pay is us subsidizing the damage done by the burning of fossil fuels for a problem that our policymakers were clearly warned about almost 50 years ago. So to those who claim that allowing dangerous fossil fuels to be burned endlessly is a matter of freedom, I say you're not looking at the big picture. Especially in a world where we now have clean energy alternatives that are cheaper, put more people to work, and don't kill up to 10 million people every year. I'll repeat Naomi Oreskes' words. She said, "Your freedom to throw a punch ends just before my nose." And on that note, that's all we have time for this evening. You've been listening to The Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto. We're on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. Join us again by tuning in on the second Friday of each month at 6 p.m. So the next time we'll be back is August 14th. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to the Natural Alternatives lineup with great hosts from Dr. Z to Courtney Bozick, John Turner, John Scardina, and more, sharing cutting-edge, thought-provoking information on health, our environment, social justice issues, and much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. And for more information on Healthy Planet, visit our website at healthyplanetusa.org. And visit our Facebook page for all archives. That's Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. But also be sure that the information that you're sharing with others is not only something that you believe in, but something that you verified as being correct and worthy of passing along. Consider being kind to those around you, including our amazing four and multi-legged friends. And finally, remember to enjoy each moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share, regardless of the challenges.
I think that what is essential for this problem is a global consciousness, a view that transcends our exclusive identifications with the generational and political groupings into which, by accident, we have been born. The solution to these problems requires a perspective that embraces the planet and the future, because we are all in this greenhouse together.
I love this song!
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom. Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.